Hello and welcome to Bustles and Broadswords, a podcast about women with swords throughout history, fiction, and the weird limbo in between. I'm your sword-wielding and storytelling host, Claire Mead. And I think variety is the spice of the warrior woman life. So sometimes, instead of only talking about women with weapons alone, we talk about women wrestling. As we press into a curious crowd somewhere on the steppes of 13th century Mongolia to catch a glimpse of the ongoing drama. Because this isn't just any random brawl. Muscles ripple with a push and pull of bodies, grappling and struggling, clouds of dust raised by dragging feet, grunts and the cheers of the crowd, before a sudden thud brings about silence. The one rule of this game of strength and skill? Touch the ground with anything other than your feet, and you lose. And now, out of 4 feet that had, to this point, treaded carefully around one another, 2 have gone heels up. The fighter left standing on their own 2 feet, a towering woman, looking down at the man she's just brought down with a hefty blend of strength and technique, the shadow of her muscular frame cutting across her opponent's defeated form, as he looks up in time to see the resolve across her face dissolve into satisfaction. As the crowd erupts in cheering, the victor calmly steps forward to accept her reward, like she has done dozens, if not hundreds of times before. And that reward comes in a form of a rumbling of cantering hooves, a myriad of fine horses, additions to her ever-growing stable. The prize she claimed from any man she defeated. Yet if she were ever to lose, they would get something far more valuable in return. Her hand in marriage. This is a woman who refused to play a game she didn't have a chance of winning. A wrestler in control of her destiny. And the inspiration for an opera that ended up taking more than a few liberties with her legacy. Yet which, in many ways, crossed paths with that of a few other iconic women. On screen and on the ring. This is Hutulun, the noblewoman wrestler of medieval Mongolia. Now, it's not always easy to relate with a 13th century figure's experience. Unless you are also a champion lady wrestler, in which case, I'm honoured you're listening. But I'm sure that the people who grew up with brothers in the audience can relate with our protagonist to some extent. So let's start there. Because Kid Hutulun, before becoming a towering terror, was a kid running along with her pack of brothers. Or 14 of them. Which can maybe kind of connect the gaps here to what led her to become someone who literally beats her potential husbands into the ground. So maybe we start to imagine a girl who naturally leant more towards so-called masculine activities. But let's actually check our cultural assumptions here. Because in 13th century Mongolia, if you're a kid old enough to ride a horse, who cares about your gender? You're picking up a bow and arrow and you're helping hunt for supper. And women were responsible for setting up and packing up camp in line with the nomadic lifestyle other clans they were part of, along with a range of other social responsibilities outside of the home. Including, as it turns out, war. So Hutulun was a rider and hunter at a young age, like other girls at the time. And she also had a will to fight, nurtured by her father Kaidu, who, as she grew up and built up her skills, was gaining power through conquest. By the time she was in her 20s, he was one of the most powerful men in Central Asia, his reign extending across parts of Mongolia, modern-day Afghanistan, Siberia, and India. And he didn't do this alone, because he didn't just nurture Hutulan's fighting skills. He was like, okay then, get on the horse, daughter. We're going warring. Yes, that is exactly what he said. Fight me. Wrestle me. Don't wrestle me. I don't know how to wrestle. Swords, no problem. Wrestling, never done it. Might be great at it. Who knows? Anyway, Hutulan would don her battle clothing, her quiver of arrows, and, yes, grasp the hilt of her sword and give it a few test swings. An ild, a sleek, slightly curved blade, meant to be held in one hand. Unlikely to have been used with her feet firmly on the ground, but instead having her other hand gripping her horse's reins, using its sweeping, cutting motion to slash her way through the horde of enemies that she fought alongside her father. Swift, brutal, and deadly. And as she came of age, her sword's lethal swish throughout the air, announcing the arrival of a buff giantess of a woman that nobody would want to cross, on and off the battlefield. And now, sipping my tea, learning about all this bloodshed, I couldn't help but wonder, was being a ruthless warrior part of Hutulan's family tree? Not that you have to have an illustrious genealogy to be a juggernaut of pure brutality, of course. Pursue your buff warrior princess dreams regardless. But it is worth asking in Hutulan's case, because she and her father have a legacy to uphold, shaped in steel, blood, and battle cries. And that's because the very name of Hutulan's great-great-grandfather is still associated with ruthless conquest to this very day. It's the one and only Genghis Khan. The first to hold the title of Khan, or Emperor of the Mongol Empire. The guy who united the nomadic tribes and made the Mongols a force to be reckoned with. That guy. Let's talk about the massive war elephant in the room. Some may have seen him as a liberator through conquest. Most saw him as a destructor. Regardless, he left a massive Mongol Empire and enabled quite a lot of new ideas, technologies, and cultural growth to disseminate, which, if you're conquering most of Central Asia and China, granted, it's probably bound to happen as a side effect. So when Genghis kicked whatever the equivalent was for a bucket for the medieval era Mongol Empire, he left a massive territory and massive shoes to fill. But plot twist. After Genghis's death, these words are credited to him. Let us reward our female offspring. So, hey, maybe Genghis could drink his respect women juice from the skull of his enemies. But adds a big pinch of salt to that cup. Empowerment for women then and now is always a question of asking which women are included in that and which ones are left behind. The women he rewarded in his life would have been his wives, concubines, or daughters, or other family relatives, high-ranking figures he rewarded accordingly when needed. Some of his daughters' involvement in conquest would have involved marrying the right people to provide political leverage and strengthen alliances, but women under Genghis Khan also fought. And women were expected to know how to ride and shoot arrows on the same level as men. After his death, though, things regressed, with the violent repression of women relatives by Genghis's son Ogade, and the murder of his sister Altalun to gain control of her territory. Once Ogade died, more queens or khatuns were able to rule across the Mongol Empire, including a woman regent, Toregene Khatun. A lot of this would be snuffed out by even more succession wars. If you think that Genghis's impressive amount of descendants and their descendants spent an obscene amount of time fighting one another for territory, well, yeah, pretty much. This is a podcast about women with swords, not about the complex legacies of conquerors and tyrants, which, by the way, I would totally call tyrants and tiaras. But this all made Hutalan the great-great-granddaughter of a man who, by all accounts, saw no reason not to place women in positions of power, and the great-granddaughter of a man who did everything he could to take it away from them. And we don't quite know about whether or not all women could fight under Kaidu. This being said, in those battles, and many others, women were already key, even if they didn't fight. While the cavalry raced ahead, using the speed of their horses as a tactical advantage, women would lead the supplies and extra horses. But at least we do know, Hutalan was there to fight. And she wasn't just swanning around as a figurehead, coasting off her glorious legacy and keeping her weapons clean. If Hutalan was handed a bow and arrow and a sword, she was going to use them, as well as her sharp strategic mind. Because more than a soldier, she was a commander, riding and directing her own regiment of heavy cavalry, armoured, armed, and deadly. But for all her weapon skills, Hutalan showed in battle what many future wrestling opponents would also feel the full force of, her strategy and the strength of her bare hands. Imagine a battle scene on the steps, ranks shifting and reforming. A shimmering sea of riders, a storm of arrows, and a chaotic clash of arms. And, swift as a shadow, a rider piercing into the enemy ranks like a knife through butter, with ruthless precision and purpose. She zeroes in on her prey and captures the enemy officer effortlessly in an iron grip of a chokehold. Not to kill him, no, not straight away. Instead, she rides off with him, trapped in her unforgiving grasp. His cries of help lose themselves in the panic and chaos of the melee as she drags him back to her father, like a trophy of war. It's a sight that many would have witnessed, but that one person immortalised on paper. In fact, quite uniquely. Describing the motion as being as easy as a hawk snatching a chicken. And who graced us with this absolute banger of a line, you may ask? A merchant, an explorer, a writer, and first and foremost, an Italian guy who, we commend him, had to commit the metal battle moves of Hutalan to paper. This is... wait, hang on. Marco? Polo? Marco? Polo? Oh, yeah, it's Marco Polo. Now, again, this is neither the Ruthless Conquerors podcast, nor the one on Venetian merchants who go on a gap year hike throughout Asia and then make a big book out of the experience that captures the intricacies of Asian politics along the Silk Road for a European audience. To be fair, that would probably be an incredibly niche podcast. Almost as niche as a podcast about women with swords throughout history with a specifically queer lens. But that's our historical Italian little guy in a nutshell. The way he is suddenly here to witness unconventional battle moves in this story is because he was appointed as a foreign emissary of the leader of the Yuan dynasty Kaidu and Hutalan were fighting against. Which was only slightly awkward because it happened to be Kaidu's own cousin Kublai Khan. Though, given the messed up stuff this family already did to one another, I think family reunions were already awkward before that. Now, to his credit, Marco Polo wasn't exactly a news anchor for battlefield events, so we'll give him a pass on the hawk-snatching chicken situation. A for effort, or, you know, maybe a B or a C for chicken. When it comes to Hutalan, he found it in his heart to be slightly more eloquent when it came to describing what she looked like, recalling that the lady was so tall and muscular, so stout and shapely withal, that she was almost like a giantess. Which, hey, look, admiring buff, tall women? Perfect. No notes. B for buff. He then kind of doubles down on how awesome Hutalan is with this observation. This damsel was very beautiful, but also so strong and brave that in all her father's realm, there was no man who could outdo her in feats of strength. In all trials, she showed greater strength than any one of them. So, at this point, we can gather that either Marco here just can't get over the novel concept of a strong woman, or he may have just a bit of a crush. Which is somehow ironic given that the adaptation of his journey into a series on Netflix, Marco Polo, does feature Hutalan as his lover. Did Marco Polo rise from the dead and write the screenplay? I mean, I hope not, because it then got cancelled after a few seasons. It does still nevertheless portray Hutalan as the warrior woman she was, which can't be said of all the later adaptations of her story. Spoiler alert. Regardless, thanks to Marco Polo and his inability to chill when it came to talking about Hutalan, alongside the Persian statesman Rashid al-Din, we have accounts of a buff giant woman who didn't just fight on par with men, but also actively beat them with their own weapons and their own games. As a rider, as an archer, and as a wrestler. So now we head to the wrestling ring, where when Hutalan is not making men into arrow pincushions, or sword target practices, or snatching them away from enemy ranks like you snatch the last chicken finger from your plate, she's beating them up, but, you know, as a hobby. And not just a little niche side hobby. Mongolian wrestling, or bok, was, and still is, part of the lifeblood of Mongolian culture. How old is wrestling in Mongolia? Oh, I'll tell you how old. Cave paintings of naked men wrestling old. I mean, at least we think they were wrestling. Don't get me started on the homoerotic implications of two naked wrestlers. Or do, I literally curated it into an exhibition. It was The Wrestlers by Henri Gaudier-Bresca, and he knew exactly what he was doing. But wrestling didn't just provide a great excuse to get way too close to your best bud, but like in a no-homo way. It was also a way to train military troops, a three-in-one way to ensure your warriors had enough strength, stamina, and skills. Genghis Khan was so hyped about wrestling that he had it celebrated as a sport meant to produce great warriors. And his descendants agreed, because wrestling became a core part of the Nadam, a great summer festival tellingly also called Erin Girvan Nadam, or the Three Games of Man. Alongside archery and horse racing, if you could achieve all three, wham bam, you're now a true man. Congratulations, please accept your goodie bag. With complimentary existential 2 a.m. thoughts about what being a real man even means. You're welcome! And no, we don't really know about many historical Mongolian women wrestlers, aside from our headstrong and just strong lady here. But what we do know is that out of all the attire Mongolian wrestlers wear, one of them is the zodog. A tight-fitting, short-sleeved jacket that is usually red or blue. It has a knotted string at the back and a daring open front, giving a full view of the wrestler's chest. This isn't just a darling Jean-Paul Gaultier-esque fashion moment, though. It is tied to the legend of a wrestler who who was unstoppable and beat all the other men, one after the other, only to then rip open the jacket to uncover a pair of breasts. So allegedly, from that point onwards, the traditional jacket had to reveal the chest to make it clear the wrestler is a man. And the presence of this moment of revelation comes from a design choice that essentially prohibits women from taking part, despite the very anecdote that shows that they not only did, but excelled at it. And yet it is also a moment associated with victory, as the winner of the wrestling match traditionally performs, just as they did a dance to initiate the fight, a victory dance, displaying their chest proudly with a turn and a wave of the arms, lending tribute to Hootalan herself. So, was the jacket-ripping wrestling woman Hootalan? She clearly didn't hide her gender while wrestling, but maybe it was part of the flex, like, hey everyone, let me remind you that I'm a woman, just to rub it in. You'd be surprised by how often I come across that. I call it the flex and flash. Very, very scientific academic terms on this podcast. But either way, Hootalan didn't let something like that get in her way of wrestling whoever she wanted. In fact, she'd use that skill to get things her way. Because soon, maybe on her way back from battle or from wrestling, Hootalan is reminded of the more so-called traditionally feminine role she is being asked to fulfill, as her parents are like, so, hey, all that warring is good and don't get us wrong, we love the wrestling, but when are you going to bring us back a husband? If you can hear that low rumble, I think that's the sound of a thousand eyes rolling in a thousand sockets of successful career women who can maybe relate. I mean, barring the bloodthirsty fighting part specifically, but hey, who knows? I don't know your life. But a warrior noblewoman is not one to back down from a challenge. Maybe she did want to marry, but it's kind of like when you're asked to do something you were going to do, but now you feel petty about doing it. So she announces that she'll make a public declaration about her marriage. And her parents at this point, knowing their headstrong daughter, who feeds men knuckle sandwiches on the regular, are either like, hopefully, oh wow, I'm sure nothing surprising will come out of this, or more likely, oh wow, I'm sure nothing surprising will come out of this. As Hootalan steps in front of the crowd assembled at Kaidu's palace, it's not hard to imagine a glint of humour in her demeanour, sizing up the hopeful suitors, some of which probably couldn't reach her shoulders, and some of which she could no doubt bench press. As she declares, sure, I'll marry whoever can beat me at wrestling. Probably the moment 50% of the men present gave up, and 50% of the remaining men found an unrelenting source of completely unfounded confidence. But that's not all. There has to be a price for entry. A wager, if you will. At which point, Hootalan presumably did the math and decided her hand in marriage could be counted in a specific currency. Horse currency. And in Hootalan math fashion, one hand in marriage equals a buttload of horses any loser would have to hand over to her care. Now, it's not entirely certain how many horses. Some sources rock up with confident swagger, remove their sunglasses, and slam their boots down on the counter, announcing, it's 100 horses. Others, more shy and rational, cough politely and say, it's probably more like 10. So let's say 10 to 100 fine horses. And look, don't point that narrative vagueness arrow at me. Okay, maybe we said 100 in the intro as clickbait, as horse bait. But all I'm going to say is, if I have to go through with marrying any man who beats me at wrestling, I'm asking for a high wager price. Also, who knows, maybe Hootalan was also a horse girl. No offense to horse girls, I used to be one. I mean, I wasn't allowed to ride the horses, but I played Barbie Riding Club on my PC, which is almost the same vibe. But horses, again, very important in Mongolian culture. By the way, 5 horses? That's maybe not a lot for Hutalan, and rightly so, but 5 stars on a review if you like this episode? Now, that would mean a lot to me. So, if this was a montage and a film, it would be set to that one part in Patti Smith's song that goes, "Horses, horses, horses, horses," with clip art of horses flying everywhere as one by one, suitors turn up to wrestle, and one by one, hit the floor. This cinematic vision will, thankfully for cinema, remain a vivid visual audio landscape I narrate to you instead. But you get the idea. Hutalan's beating all the guys and making major gains. Equine gains. She's already ripped, after all. Though I'm sure a steady stream of men challenging her to wrestle was a key part of her workout routine. And all this culminates to the moment a new challenger approaches. And I don't know his name, so I'll naturally have to call him 1K Horse Guy. You'll never guess why or where this is going. We do know that this guy is a prince. He's handsome, he's tall, and he's presumably strong and skilled enough to try his hand at wrestling Hutalan. But most importantly, he steps up and is like, huh, 10 to 100 fine horses? That's chump change. Chump horse change. Get this, I will wager 1,000 horses. Oh wow, who would have seen this coming? Hutalan eyes him up and down and is like, yeah, sure, I'll take that action. He seems confident. This could be interesting. So imagine our wrestling champion's surprise when, that very night, 1K Horse Guy finds her and has something to declare. And it's not flirting. It's not intimidation. It's straight up begging. He goes, please, please, oh, please, can you just throw this fight? I'm not going to win, and I just really want to marry you. Like, just do me a solid, and I'll be the best husband ever. Please? At which point, Hutalan probably stares straight into the camera and sighs, before her damning response. I'll never allow myself to be beaten if I can help it, but hey, good luck. Before walking away, maybe leaving 1K Horse Guy with some hope that just maybe this wrestling noblewoman might find it in her heart to make an exception to her track record. So we're now in the Great Hall of Kaidu's palace, and everyone has come to watch this fight. I mean, come on, the guy's pledged 1,000 horses. As the match starts, he makes a few moves. Maybe she lets him gain a bit of confidence, a bit of momentum, a bit of hope she's really going to let him win. And then, in an instant, she grabs him and knocks the wind out of him and effortlessly throws him on the hard pavement of the palace. But even more painfully humiliating is the noble lady standing over him, enjoying her victory and soon her horses. Exactly how many horses did she end up accumulating? Obviously, there may be some exaggerating here. But given most historical sources don't go with a buttload of horses as a descriptor, they go with the next best thing numbers-wise. 10,000 horses. But if there's one thing most of these stories have in common, is that the gender non-conforming, rule-breaking woman does, most of the time, eventually marry. No, Hutalan does not run off into the sunset with her 10k horses, as incredible as that vision is. Awkwardly, the more she grows older without a husband, the more her father's enemies are like, well, that must mean you're in an incestuous relationship with him, which, ah yes, what a reasonable, logical conclusion. Whether it's for that reason, trying to ensure her own lineage, or maybe, hey, even just love, Hutalan does marry in the end. Some say he's a ruler, others say that he's a dashing assassin that was originally sent to murder her dad, then was imprisoned and gained the favour of his once enemies, which feels like a controversial, offbeat choice Hutalan would go for. To his credit, her father doesn't just want her to marry and fall back in line. He actively wants her to become his successor to the Khanate, and for her to be Khatun. But there's several versions there. Either all his male relatives go, yeah, no. Or Hutalan says, actually, yeah, no. I'd rather be fighting as a commander. Either way, this leads to her being a commander in her ruling brother's army after her father dies, before following him in death only 5 years later. Not sure exactly how she died, whether by a politically motivated assassination or on the battlefield, or one disguised as the other. But like her, it's swift and brutal. But never fear, because Hutalan's legacy lives on. Okay, maybe do fear a little bit, because this isn't the case of a biopic taking a few artistic liberties. It's a stage adaptation that seems to fly in the very face of what its original inspiration would have wanted. Because now, we cut from warring wrestling and horses to the opera, where instead, high dramatics wrestle with high notes. A richly adorned woman makes her way onto the stage, cold, haughty, and dangerous. Any suitor hoping to marry her has to solve three riddles. Fail them, then perish. Literally. One prince passes his married a princess entrance exam, but she fails him anyway, as she's like, nah. So he offers her the option of guessing his name before dawn, and if she does, he'll die. And then it's all taken up a notch because, plot twist, if the name is not discovered by morning, everyone in Peking gets it. Murder, that is, they all get murdered. Shenanigans ensue, including negotiation, a stabbing, and high drama, worthy of peak reality TV. Just with more singing and less confession booze. In the end, the prince kisses the princess and she's like, dang, making out isn't that bad. Who knew? He gives her his name and she decides to spare him, declaring that the whole time his name was Love. That's right, everyone. Love is in the destination of the journey, of the friends and deadly riddles you make along the way. I don't know either. But this is the opera Turandot by Puccini, and believe it or not, Hutalan's story was the inspiration. How did we go from a Mongolian wrestler, daughter of a Khan, who wrestled her suitors to see if they were worth marrying, to a Chinese princess won over by love whose only weapon is a set of riddles? Look no further than Europeans just straight up making things up and making these things racist and sexist for no reason. In the early 18th century, François Pétry de la Croix chooses to annoy me personally by writing a book that just merges various things from different Asian literary motifs, in which he calls Hutalan Turandot, which means Turkish daughter. A reference to the fact that Kaidu and Hutalan's branch of the family, the House of Ogedei, is linked to the Turkic tribe branch of Genghis Khan's descendants. But also, if historians looked at my name that went, ah yes, instead of Claire Mead, I will call you daughter of a French mother and a British father, I would kind of have an issue with that. And then Lacroix is like, oh no, not wrestling, that's too unladylike. Let's go with riddles. And apparently he doesn't like horse girls either, because now you lose, you die. By this point, it's too late for any kind of historical accuracy to come true, as later European playwrights and writers didn't only go with the notion of a prideful, cold and cruel princess who killed unworthy suitors via riddles and finally, in the end, succumbed to love. They ran with it, and Puccini's opera was a full part of that. Also, making her Chinese now? Because hey, it's not like Asia is a continent with a complex set of different countries, territories and cultures. Cultural specificity? These guys don't know her, or know how to write Asian women, regardless of nationality, without being racist. Because this isn't just an isolated incident of bumbling men taking a few liberties in their biopic adaptation. It's the start of a whole wave of racism that doesn't only mix up distinct cultures, but attributes lasting stereotypes to Asian women, like the Dragon Lady trope. A stereotype of Asian women, specifically often East Asian, but also Southeast Asian and South Asian women, as being sexualized, deceitful and dangerous. A pendant to the just-sexualized butterfly stereotype of the Asian woman as submissive. Again, specifically often targeted at East Asian women, but South Asian women are also often included in this stereotype. Incidentally, the term Dragon Lady comes from a comic strip, Terry and the Pirates, which ran from the 30s to the 70s, about a villainous woman who was actually inspired by a historical Chinese pirate woman, Lai Huaisan. This trope made its way onto the movie screen and both limited and dictated the roles Asian actresses could take on. Pigeonholed into shallow, cookie-cutter archetypes that focused on exotifying them rather than showing them as complex human beings. Leading us back to Turandot, not her opera version, but a stage adaptation of the play Turandot by 19th century Count Carlo Gozzi. A commedia dell'arte, more playful than the Osir opera, there's quite a lot of comedy, and it is also the origin of what we now know as panto. But still portraying Turandot as this cold, dangerous figure who finally submits to love. In 1937, the stage adaptation at the Westport Country Playhouse has her portrayed by an actress who knew all about pigeonholing, casting discrimination, and the challenge of pushing past an archetype. A complex woman, playing the interpretation of another across different performances and reimaginings of her story, in which truth and identity beyond stereotype struggles to wrestle its way to the surface. This was Wong Yusong, or as she was known under her actress name, Anna May Wong. The Chinese-American actress, by this point, had suffered a devastating blow a few years before, when she got refused the leading role of the Chinese character Orlan in the film The Good Earth. It went to a white actress donning yellowface instead. One theory is that this was due to the anti-miscegenation laws, meaning a white actor's on-screen lover would have to be white. Either way, racism was fully a part of that decision. She was offered a supporting role, Lotus, a seductress. And she said, "Thanks, but no thanks." This blow had come after Daughter of Shanghai, a film in which she had finally been able to embrace and shape a lead role beyond the either submissive and self-sacrificing or deceitful and dangerous archetypes she was usually given in a supporting role, which must have made losing the role in The Good Earth all the more painful. And a few years before that, in Shanghai Express, despite her supporting role, her charisma duels on screen was the equally magnetic presence of Marlene Dietrich. With something of a vibe about her elegant and smooth exchanges with the openly bisexual actress, as they both play strong-willed courtesans aboard a train in the midst of a Chinese civil war. But Dietrich's Shanghai Lily character gets a happy ending. Wang's, the character of Hu Fei, stabs a man to help the white lead get the happy ending. Wong herself would die decades later, just before her comeback cinema role. After a string of television appearances and B-movies that provided far better Chinese and Chinese-American representation than the Hollywood ones she had been cast in before. And after failing, with great personal sadness, to connect with China's culture as an American, nevertheless making a film out of her experience. Yet, in her embodiment of these earlier roles, and her presence nevertheless on screen to give a complex performance within the confines of what she was given, Anna Mae Wong's acting legacy remains alive and well, and with it, her iconic status within the LGBTQIA community, and not just for her queer vibes on and off screen. As someone who had a few extra close gal pals in her life aside from Dietrich, and also never married, but for her outsider status, neither fully fitting into one world or another, and wielding a double-edged sword of expressing her authentic self outside the spotlight and enacting wider Hollywood representation through negative archetypes and stereotypes that survive to this very day. But now we bring it back to the thing that started off this entire episode, wrestling. Which brings us to 2014. As she approaches the mat, Sukhijin Zerenshimed, Shimdi as her nickname, is representing Mongolia as a woman wrestler at the World Wrestling Championships, barely a decade after the Olympic Games opened the sport to women. Wrestling in Mongolia had remained a man's game for centuries, but Shimdi, like her protagonist, had lineage to back up her tough-as-nails attitude. Her father had been a champion wrestler before his death, while she was still a child, which led her to the steps of the local wrestling club, with more than a gender imbalance to correct. More so a material chance at using the sport to improve her livelihood, and that of other women across Mongolia. The match is a flurry of lunges, pulls and powerful slamming into her opponent. 6 minutes of grappling to gain the upper hand. Before the final score emerges, and she rises victorious, bringing back gold, and making her Mongolia's second woman champion, welcomed back home with cheers and praise. In some ways, continuing the legacy of Hutulan, misremembered and watered down on the European stage, yet her memory still vibrant and alive in Mongolian culture as who she was. As a warrior, a champion wrestler, and a woman who didn't let anything get in her way she couldn't defeat. And, if all of that failed, who could always resort to trampling you. With her 10,000 horses. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a wild ride. Seriously though, I learned a lot about Mongolian culture and history in the process. The story has always been really, really fascinating to me, and it's also been great to find out more about Anna Mae Wong. You can access any additional images, show notes, and the transcript for this episode via the link in the episode's description. And I also want to hear your stories and your questions. If you have a story about a sword lady, real or fictional, or maybe a bit of both that you'd like to tell me about or ask questions about, write in at bustlesandbroadswords@gmail.com. And in the meantime, you can follow the podcast at Bustle Sword Pod on social media. And you can also find me on most social media platforms trying to procrastinate from writing, narrating, and producing this podcast at Carmine Claire. Stay safe, sword lady lovers, and see you in a future episode. Next time on Bustles and Broadswords.
This is the Queen of Swords of the 19th century Californian dueling scene, the Amazon of the American racetracks, the 19th century jouster with as much skill in sword fighting as in showmanship, or showwomanship.
On guard, and see you then.